Welcome to Jazz Backstory, Episode 30, Military Music, Part 2. It was not planned, but the 80th anniversary of D-Day took place during the time when we assembled the episodes related to musicians in the service. Watching, once again, the grainy black-and-white film of that historic event reminded me of the incredible sacrifice involved. It's sobering to realize that America is rarely not involved in armed conflict somewhere in the world. In this episode, we are shifting our focus from World War II to America's next major conflicts. The majority of musicians drafted into the service during times of conflict were able to make use of their talents and hold an instrument in their hands instead of a rifle. Drummer Jake Hanna points out the obvious reason. Besides the fact that musicians were rarely molded into effective soldiers.
At what age were you inclined to think that, hey, maybe I can make a living as a drummer?
Well, I never did anything else. So I never thought of it. Just loved it. You know, I never thought of ever doing anything else, you know, ever. I just loved it, you know. Even when I went to service, I figured, well, I'll go in and be a gunner, you know. But they eliminated gunners. You know, in the 50s, they eliminated everything was electronic. And they came up with the jets then. Jets were invented. So they wouldn't let me go to handle a gun anyway, you know. But they, you played a musical instrument, they pulled you right into a band flight. And if you're a doctor or a medicine, they pulled you right into that area and gave you a commission. You can't train a musician in 4 years. Just take somebody off the street, say, all right, you're in the service, oh, you're going to, we need two drummers over here, you're going to, forget it. You can't train a guy. You say, who plays the drum? You do? Over here. As a doctor, we can't train a doctor in 4 years. So you're automatically in when you go in. That's automatically what you do. Most people, they can train you. Infantry,
that's true.
Everybody shoot a gun, you know.
I never even thought of
that. Yeah, no, they have to have specialists, and you got to go right away. They can train guys with dot and dashes and radio people. They can get that done in 6 months, you know. But not a musician. Play a march, and then play a little symphony, and then play a little dance job, and play a show. In fact, most musicians can't do all that. You know? Really.
That's true. Yeah.
Often referred to as the Forgotten War, a trip to the Korean conflict was the concern for young men in the early 1950s. Junior Mance and Cannonball Adderley, two of my favorite artists, were in uniform during that time period. Picture, if you will, Junior Mance walking guard duty. A jazz pianist who had already recorded with major artists, Junior pondered his impending deployment.
I couldn't get into the Army band because I didn't play a marching instrument. You know, back then, into an Army band, you had to play a marching instrument. So I was slated to go to Korea, you know. So the basic training, you know, they give you a rifle, an empty rifle, and, you know, teaching how to walk guard duty. So the post they assigned me was around the service club. And while I'm walking around it, I hear this great music. I say, wow, some fantastic records, you know. And I was walked slow every time I, you know, got past the walk behind, you know, where the music was coming from. I'd walk very slow, you know. And when my rest period came, I ran back to the service club. And when I ran inside, I looked, and there's this big band sitting on the stage. This roly-poly guy leading it and playing alto. And I stopped, and I was frozen, you know. I listened. I just ran up to the stage then, and I listened to a couple tunes. And something I never do is ask to sit in. I always wait to be asked, you know. But then I couldn't hold back. I said, hey, man, can I sit in the band? So the piano player, I was standing near him, and he heard me. So he reaches down off the stage and pulls me up and says, yeah, man, come on, play. But I'm sitting there, you know, I'm walking guard with combat boots, helmet, cartridge belt, you know. Jeez.
Yeah, so that's great.
Cannonball's giving me like, such a look of disdain I've never seen in my life, you know.
Wow,
who's this kid, you know? And the rest of the guys in the band are looking and say, huh? So Cannonball asks, he says, what do you want to play? I said, well, play anything out of your book. And by saying it like that, you know, that kind of caught him by surprise. I said, well, maybe the guy is a musician, you know. So they call it an easy tune, easy bebop tune with blues changes. They played the head, and then they gave me the first solo Cannonball. I said, all right, you got it. So what did he say that for? You know, here I haven't been near piano in 6 weeks, you know. I just played, and I stretched out, and then he starts like, yeah, man, go ahead, play some more. You know, and I look, and I happen to look up at the rest of the band, and I see heads going like
all
that.
Right. There you go.
And after a while, I say, "Yeah, yeah, man, go ahead, go ahead." Uh-huh. I must have played about 99 courses, you know. Then the band came in, you know, and I read the charts and all.
That's
you
great.
Know. And so after the after that was over, Cannonball comes over to the piano. And says, "Yeah, man, that's great." He says, "What's your name?" I say, "Junior Mance." And Sonny Stitt was one of his heroes then, and I had, you know, worked with Sonny and Gene before I got drafted. Sonny Stitt and Gene Ammons, the group they had, you know. So he likes, he says, "Ha, ha, ha." He says, "If you're Junior Mance, what are you doing here in those clothes?" Yeah. I said, "What are you doing here?" So we had a big laugh about it, and then he says, "Are you coming to the band, I guess?" I said, "No, they won't let me." He says, "Because I don't play a marching instrument." So I finished the night. That happened to be their last set, that last hour, you know. So the next day was the day that I'm on the infiltration course. You know what the infiltration course is? That's when you're out in training and they shoot machine gun bullets 3 feet above the ground. Well, the guns are fixed so that they can't do that, you know.
Yeah.
And usually it's on dry ground. Well, this day they chose to take hoses and make it real muddy. You know? And you don't stand up. You're going to crawl, believe me. So when we got to the end of the infiltration course, I saw this Jeep. And I got close. I says, "That's Cannonball." You know, and he goes up to the first sergeant and hands him a slip of paper. And the first sergeant just looks at it and says, "Okay, man, stick off. They want you at headquarters." So I jumped in the Jeep with Cannonball. As soon as we got out of earshot, he says, "Okay, now listen carefully." He says, "These orders are phony." I didn't come to the army to go to jail. I was late getting there anyway because I was on the road with Gene and Sonny. You know? He says, "Trust me, you know." I said, "What choice have I got?" So then he says, "We're going back to the barracks, and I want the band director to hear you." He says, "Maybe we can do something, pull some kind of strings to get you in the band." I said, "Oh, great." I said, "Oh, I'm for that, you know." So we went back. And the band director didn't know about anything but marches. He was like a career soldier anyway, who was getting out soon, fortunately. You know? And all he knew was marches. He didn't know anything about jazz. So Cannonball had stacked the deck. When we got back to the area, to the barracks, I didn't know he had told the guys, "Now, when Junior starts playing, whoop it up. Say, yeah, pat your fingers, you know, snap and make it look like, you know, he's good, you know." So I got back, and the band director says, you know, the usual things like your name and how long you've been in the Army and so forth. He says, "Well, play something. Let me hear you play something." He says, "Well, what should I play?" He says, "Oh, play anything, anything." You know? So I just started playing some blues, you know, the tempo like that, you know. And sure enough, the guy jumped in. You know? And so he's standing there, you know, like a real soldier. So I went through about 2 or 3 songs, you know, and so he gave me one of these backhanded compliments. I got. He says, "Well, you must be good. They think you are." Thanks a lot. So then he, Cannonball forgot to brief me on the important question. "What's your other instrument?" I said, "I'm sorry, I only play piano." He says, "Oh, that presents a problem." You know. So back to training I went. And then, but the guy I did make arrangements with my sergeant to let me get off the nights, like about 3 nights a week that they played the service club, to go and play that, you know. And I did. So one night I came, when I reported that to the service club to play with the guys, and they were looking a little bit downhearted because the drummer had gotten orders to ship to Germany. And he was a good drummer. They hated to lose a good drummer, but also he was the company clerk who, you know, which is the, they do all the administrative work. He's the next thing under the first sergeant, you know, and he usually knows everything, you know, and he would, I found out later why they wanted a company clerk, you know, that they could really stay tight with.
Yeah.
You know, because he would warn them of impending inspections or like that, you know.
Wow.
And, I asked Cannonball, I said, "Well, that's a full-time job, isn't it, in the daytime?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, how do you do that?" He says, "Well, first you have to know how to type." I said, "I can type. I learned how to type in high school, you know. right away. You could see light bulbs lighting up all the way. You know. So that's how I got in, you know. And, you know, it's just, it's something I'll never know. The basic training outfit that I was training with was sent to Korea. And I only met four guys that came back out of this group. I understand that our whole company was absorbed into the 24th Infantry Division, which got caught in a hell of an ambush. You know, and I wonder, you know, like, you know, I sort of think that Cannonball might have saved my life. You know, if it wasn't for him, I might not be here.
Junior Mance, company clerk by day, jazz pianist by night. After military service, Junior's musical associations included work with Dizzy Gillespie, Joe Williams, and Dinah Washington. He eventually led his own trios for many productive years. To hear Junior tell a fascinating childhood story, check out episode 2 of our podcast. Saxophonist Frank Foster, in a similar predicament as Junior Mance, panicked and went AWOL, absent without leave. He shared his Korean War story during our 1998 interview.
I trained basic training in an all-black company that was part of an all-black battalion.
Right.
As soon as I got to Japan and Korea, it was all over. It was totally integrated.
I see.
I was in Japan for a very short while and only taking a school training for to be a clerk typist. This was to stay out of the war zone.
Yeah.
So after that, I was shipped to the war zone. And I was in a service company of a infantry regiment for a few months. And then I went and auditioned for the division band and got in the division band. And there was quite a bit of playing. So I was able to stay up on the instrument.
Great. That was early in the war, wasn't it?
52. Yes. 51, I was drafted into the Army, and most of 51 was spent in the California area.
Uh-huh.
San Francisco, and I went AWOL for over a month over Thanksgiving and Christmas, because I was afraid that after I finished basic training, the idea of going actually into the war as an infantry rifleman, you know, that just scared me to death. So I said, well, I'm going to stay out here and live a little. And there was no timetable as to when I was going to turn myself in. But there was a lady that I was friendly with who persuaded me to turn myself in. She said, please, turn yourself in. Don't get caught. If they catch you out here, I'll never see you again.
No.
That was the rationale she used on me. And certain other people who professed to be in the know said, turn yourself into the chaplain. He'll understand. So after I went back to turn myself in, I went straight to the chaplain and I told him my story. And he said, well, son, you're a musician, is that right? Yes. What kind of music do you play? And why did I tell him I played jazz? He said, oh, that's too bad. You know, that jazz is... that's not the music you should be playing. It's all right if you play church music, you know, religious music. And these are his exact words, and this is the title of one of my chapters. You'll have to give up that jazz, son. And that's the title of chapter 7 in my book.
All right.
So I was under a military court-martial, and I was sentenced to a month in the stockade. And I spent 5 days in the stockade, after which I was shipped to the Far East. And I landed in Japan. And a few weeks later, I was sent to Korea. And the fighting was going on hot and heavy. And this was early 1952, in March. March 9th, to the exact day I landed in Korea. And it was a horrible looking day, and I'll never forget that. But I spent 13 months and 13 days in Korea.
You have a pretty good memory for significant
Yeah, I can't
dates.
Remember where I was yesterday, but this I remember. And after being released or shipped back to the United States, I came back to Detroit. Now, this was May of 1953. My first day in town, don't have any civilian clothes, walking around in my Army uniform. I ran into an old friend who said, Count Basie's looking for you. I said, Count Basie's looking for me? Nobody knows I'm here. I said, Count Basie's looking for you. You better go over to the I forget what the ballroom, the Greystone Ballroom or something like that. The Basie Band was actually appearing that night. So I went over there, and surely enough, Lockjaw Davis was planning to leave, and Ernie Wilkins and Jimmy Wilkins, who were in the band at the time, and they, along with Billy Eckstein, had recommended me for the band, but they didn't know where I was at the time. So I showed up.
That is really wild.
The right place at the right time. And so 3 months later, I was in the Count Basie Orchestra, July 27th, 1953.
Frank Foster fashioned a robust career in jazz as a player, composer, and leader of his Loud Minority Big Band and the Count Basie Orchestra, after Basie passed in 1984. Our Jazz Oral History Project began in 1995, and I maintained a lengthy try-to-get-with-this-musician list regarding future interviews. There are two other sobering lists, one of musicians who've passed away since we interviewed them, and a second list I title Regrets, the artists who passed away before our effort began. The virtuoso baritone saxophonist Pepper Adams, 1930 to 1986, is on that list. I'm currently reading Pepper Adams, Saxophone Trailblazer, by Gary Karner. Mr. Karner has skillfully captured the saxophonist's life story, including his Korean War experience, a period that Pepper tried to forget. What he did share is spot on for this podcast episode. The following is a paraphrased excerpt from the book. Traveling nearly every day for the next 6 months, Adams performed in about 250 shows for U.S. troops and their allies. Platoon member Al Gould said, "Where there were 50 men or more, we'd put on a show." The roads that the convoy navigated were unpaved and rocky, producing clouds of dust and only allowing them to plod along at a top speed of 15 miles an hour. The slow pace during the day would enable soldiers to observe the rugged terrain, including marijuana that was growing near the road. Someone would yell, "Pot!" The convoy would screech to a halt, and the excited soldiers would jump out. They rarely had a chance to bathe, only occasionally having access to cold showers when asked to do impromptu performances for officers at the front line. Danger lurked everywhere. Adams had the horrifying experience of witnessing a gunner carrying a box of ammunition and wearing a bandolier around his torso suffer a direct hit and explode. Korea was such a ghastly experience that Pepper chose not to discuss it, though he did acknowledge that he was fortunate to survive. Going over on a troop ship jammed to the gills and then coming back on a troop ship and having it half full made me realize something about a casualty rate. Every so often, Pepper was able to break away from his squadron. A couple of times I hitched along the front line, carrying a carbine in one hand and my alto in the other, to visit Frank Foster, said Adams. Frank was in the 7th Military Division Band. We sure had some good sessions. End quote. Two East Coast-based saxophonists meet up along the front lines in Korea to jam. You can't make these things up. Except for the willing and patriotic volunteers, young men have always been particularly concerned about the draft during times of war. In 1969, the Vietnam conflict was escalating, and a draft lottery based on birth dates was instituted. Broadcast on live television, it was like a bingo game from hell. I well remember standing shoulder to shoulder in a crowd of fellow music students, breathlessly waiting for the birth dates to be read off those ominous-looking ping-pong balls. I was lucky. Some of my buddies were not. My housemate, pianist Onaje Allen Gums, was in that crowd.
Because what happened is that, of course, during the time that we were graduating from Fredonia was in the middle of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And they had a lottery system. And my number was 49.
Oh,
my number was up. So I was going to Vietnam. And I went through the whole thing of going down and the whole draft thing and taking the test and couldn't bring myself to lie or do stuff.
Right.
And of course, you know, I was the radio shipped me off. But I decided I wasn't going. And I wasn't going to flee to Canada. So the only thing I had at my disposal was to plead a conscientious objector. And I used my music as my religion, because that would be religious reasons. And I went through different anecdotes, going back to in high school, when I was with Jerry Gonzalez, that Latin band, there was always fights. And I never get in the middle of it because I value their friendship. So it was always hard for me to draw sides and take sides, you know. And I just did this whole paper, like almost like a thesis, you know, about my feelings about war and feelings about killing people. And I had to have some people to write affidavits to support my feelings. And Dr. Billy Taylor was one of the people that wrote a letter. And he, at that time, I didn't realize I found it maybe 10 years ago. My mother had a trunk with some of my stuff in it. And actually, he is the reason I chose the name Onaje. Because I found the name in a book of African names as the sensitive one. Mm-hmm. And Billy wrote in print that Alan's a very sensitive person. And he wanted to say he will be of no use to you. You know, in other words, I guess his thing was he'll sabotage your mission because the man is so against killing people that you'll have a hard time.
Yeah.
So you really don't want him. And I did it fair and square. I mean, I went up there. My father went with me. He's a World War II vet, the whole nine yards. But he supported the fact that I didn't want to go and why I didn't want to go. And he stood by me. And at one point they asked me, if someone harmed your mother, would you retaliate? And I broke down and started crying. And I said no. And I remember I just couldn't contain myself. I just started crying. I wanted them to know that I was sincere.
Right.
So the only difference was the fact that instead of waiting 2 weeks, I found out that night that I got it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I was, you know, given the 4F classification. No, actually getting 4F classification. And I'm waiting to find out what this manager is going to do to keep me out of going now that I got this deferment. Because usually you have to go work someplace that's so far away from your house, you really wish you had gone in the Army, you know?
Oh.
And that's why they make it very uncomfortable for you. Usually working like a mental institution or something like that.
Right.
So around that time, a friend of mine named Sabu, a great bass player, Sabu Adeola, who lived in Buffalo, who I met in my senior year at Fredonia, because one of the fellow students took me to Buffalo. So I met some musicians during that time. And he called me and said, we have a program we'd like you to teach. It's a Model Cities program. And it turned out that this program fit the requirements of a CO deferment, because it had to be a nonprofit organization more than 50 miles away from your home base.
Oh.
Voila.
Yeah.
So I started working right away. I didn't wait for them to assign me. I just started working. And they wrote, the person who was in charge, Sabu, signed a form.
Mm-hmm.
I had to send away to show what I was making and all the kind of stuff. So about 6 months later, I get reclassified. So I'm relieved of my CO classification. But in other words, you'll never be called.
In 1971, Onaje was a senior at SUNY Fredonia. I was 1 year behind. The Buddy Rich Orchestra came to the school for a concert in our large hall. Buddy's pianist fell ill, and someone hipped him to the fact that the Fredonia Music Department had an outstanding jazz pianist. In a classic fairy tale scenario, Onaje sat in and played chorus after chorus on the first tune, encouraged enthusiastically by Mr. Rich and the band. After the partisan audience calmed down, Buddy, over the mic, said, "Hey, you want a gig?" All of us jazz guys, who had dreamt of this exact scenario for ourselves, yelled variations of, "Yeah, go for it! Hit the road, man!" A self-described sensitive person, Onaje was also wise beyond his years. He passed on the opportunity. He realized his temperament and Buddy Rich's were not a match made in musical heaven. Onaje went on to work with Woody Shaw, Nat Adderley, and the Thad Jones Mel Lewis Orchestra, and recorded as a leader on multiple CDs. He passed away in April 2020, a victim of complications from COVID. In 2022, De Kruijf Place in the Bronx was co-named Onaje Allengum's Way. Music provided an effective morale builder for soldiers fighting overseas. As we have heard, it was most often provided by talented fellow soldiers. Professional entertainers who were well past military age were also engaged to undertake tours, raising the spirits of homesick soldiers. Comedian and actor Bob Hope made a tradition of it, touring Vietnam 9 separate times, often accompanied by Les Brown and his band of renown. Hal Espinoza was in the trumpet section and shared his story during our 2024 interview.
You know, I only auditioned twice in my life. One was to get the scholarship at Arizona State. The other is when I got drafted after I graduated from Arizona State. I was drafted in the Army, and after the six weeks of basic training, then they'd send you to advanced training, I think that's what they called it. And I asked if I could audition for the band. So they sent me to the band, and there's this little cornet player. I was 25 then, I think, 23 or 24. Anyway, this guy took me in, and he looked like he had to be 55 or 60 years old, you know, some wrinkled faces, sergeant, you know, the whole thing. Just the nicest old guy. He had me play a couple of scales. and read a simple little line. He said, "Okay, you're in." So I spent my 2 years at Fort Ord, right outside of Monterey, California, which is a beautiful area. So I never had to really go overseas. It was just after the Korean War. I had some friends in college that ended up going in the war to Korea. So I was able to bypass that because I was deferred going to college all that time. And as soon as I graduated, I got my greetings.
So you ended up in a different way going to a war with Bob Hope. Is that correct? I was wondering what the various conditions were like when you were playing for the service men and women in Vietnam that would set up a stage for you and carry your own sound
Oh,
system.
that's right. I just went way to the right, didn't I? So as soon as I joined the band, we started doing the Bob Hope show, and then along with that came the Christmas show. So we're able to, we got all kinds of shots. We'd get probably 6 or 7 shots each, malaria and all kinds of other stuff, because we go into jungle areas, then into Alaska where it's freezing in the same 2 week time. So when we had fly to Bangkok, that was our home away from home. Every day we'd fly over to Vietnam, about a 2 hour flight. And I think it was about 2 hours, maybe less. And they wouldn't tell us where we were going until we got on the plane. Then they'd issue us our information where we were going to the first job. And we would land. We were in these, I think it was 130. I don't recall the names of the planes, but they're the kinds that would small, and they, on the side of the fuselage, they had the netted seats, like the parachute jumpers when they sit there and then hook up and then go out the chairs. That's what they flew us in. And so we'd land at the camp, put a show on. They'd have the stage already set, no cover in a lot of places. And in Vietnam, it was 105, 110 degrees out, because in December, that's their summer. And we had a couple of guys, Butch Stone and Lou Ciotti, a tenor player, both kind of fainted on stage, because of the heat and the sun bearing down on us. And the military always gave us their hats, Squad 47 or whatever the names. I've got a collection of these caps in the garage that I kept all these years. But the troops, afterward, when we were through playing and performing, they'd come up to the band and thank us so much for being there, leaving home over Christmas to entertain them. And I thought then, even if I didn't get paid, I'd want to do this, just because of how I felt, doing it.
When we see movies about Vietnam now, usually the soundtrack are tunes from pop radio that were occurring during the Vietnam War, Sly and the Family Stone and that kind of thing. Yet you're saying that these young men were responding to music that had more to do with their parents than it did with them.
And the big band era, it started to fold, I guess, when Tommy Dorsey died, and I did get a chance to work with Bob Crosby, but he wasn't a big band then. But he's an old guy in an old band. But the bands were still working pretty well. Les Brown was working well. The road bands, you had road bands out there, like Ray Anthony. When I got there, I remember we were in Da Nang performing after when we had landed where the Freedom Hill was, where they'd have 25,000 troops sitting up on the hill, and they had a stage facing the hill. They had buses over to it, which is about a mile over to this hill, and then through a little village, Vietnamese village. So there's a Jeep in front of us with one of these machine guns in there, and the guy standing up with a machine gun, and a Jeep behind us with the same machine gun. And the bus that we were in, they had real tight metal nets across the windows so nobody could launch a grenade in. So you're driving down this road, dirt road, and you're looking at the village, and there's dogs running around and Vietnamese people kind of looking up. And we're going through, and it had kind of an eerie feeling. But anyway, when we, after we did that show, we got back in the plane. In fact, it's coming back to me. It's the reason why we kind of left in a hurry was the sun was going down behind the hill. And so we hadn't finished the show, but the general in charge of the troops there jumped up on stage and had to interrupt Bob Hope and tell him, "Bob, we've got to dismiss troops. Sun's going down. We can't take a chance." And they dismissed all the troops. They got us in our helicopters. They had helicopters to fly us down to the runway. We got in the plane and took off. And as we were taking off, we could hear bing, bing, bing. And ground fire hit our plane. And then we swerved, came around and landed so they could check the fuselage, make sure no gas lines were hit. And after about 15 minutes, they cleared the airfield and we took off and went back to Bangkok. So that was kind of a scary moment.
I think that probably put every other gig you played for the rest of your life in some kind of perspective.
It did.
The next time I start to moan about a gig, the hour drive, the load in, and the lousy acoustics, Hal's "We Were Shot At" gig story should help me keep things in perspective. If we look at the big picture, the musician soldier made out fairly well, especially during times of relative global peace. In many cases, their skills improved through constant performing and handling the diverse musical tasks required of them. A number of our most accomplished artists today played their way through the military and immediately renewed their career paths afterwards. A case in point, Google drummer icon Steve Gadd performing "Sissy Strut" with the U.S. Army Studio Band. He rips it up, surrounded by marvelous big band musicians. Only their Army uniforms make them stand out from any other early hot 1970s jazz band. Today's military branches boast jazz, funk, rock, and classical ensembles, all performing at the highest level. Time to send out a grateful acknowledgement to our Jazz Backstory team, my tech-savvy Hamilton student assistant and fine saxophonist, Michael Coe, our transcriptionist and editor, Romy Bertel, and digital scholarship technologist, Doug Higgins. Episodes 31 and 32 will offer something that we can always use more of, words of wisdom offered up by a wise group of jazz veterans. See you on the flip side.